This is a recording from Jabba. On October 19th, 2007, Jabba hosted a one-day conference called Crafting Intentional Communities, Cooperative Living Along Life's Journey. The event was designed to explore new housing and living innovations for seniors to live, grow, and age in community. This is the second in a series of podcasts from that event.
It is my pleasure to present to you our next speaker, Zev Pace. About a month ago, I was fortunate enough to be able to attend his Elder Co-Housing Conference in Boulder, Colorado. This man knows his stuff, so it is a real treat for you to be able to hear him today. If you get to the point that your dream is going to include a co-housing conference, a co-housing community, I certainly encourage you to go to the conference that he does in Boulder at least once or twice a year. If you're not quite ready to make that big a jump yet, I definitely encourage you to go to his website, which is www.eldercohousing.org. This gives you an opportunity to hook into all the other groups around the country that are at various stages of creating their own co-housing community. Some are at the point they're still looking for people. Some are at the point they've got people, they're looking for land. Some are in the building process, and some are already moved in. But it's a valuable tool for you as you start exploring these new opportunities and options for how you want to live your life in the later stages, in some, probably some of your most productive stages. But until you can get home and get into that computer and see that website, I encourage you to take advantage of the wonderful opportunity you have here today to hear Zev speak, and take advantage of the break time and lunch time and the reception this afternoon to go up to him and ask him questions and just get some more feedback. I know he's playing a very large part in helping my dream to have a co-housing development come true, and I'm sure that he can help you too. So right now it is my pleasure to present to you Zev Pace.
Magical microphone. It pops on when you start talking. I love it. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. This is my second trip to Charlottesville. I was here about 12 years ago, working with a group that at that time was called the Charlottesville Co-Housing Group, and they worked for quite a few years, and then it didn't happen. Unfortunately, that is the case sometimes. But I was invited here not to talk about co-housing in the general sense, but to talk about a more specific version of it called elder co-housing. And you'll see, I describe that term in my presentation because the word elder means so many things to so many people. But I have a feeling that in this group, you understand that when we talk about elder, we're not talking about someone that is elderly necessarily, or someone who is, you know, at death's doorstep, but someone who really is an elder in their community, a wise person. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. My background, I grew up in a small, little, cozy community in Southern California called Los Angeles. So I really understand what it's like to know all of your neighbors. I actually escaped from Los Angeles when I was about 17 and then continued on up the coast and learned a lot more about what it means to live in community through my college experience and living in shared housing. And then eventually starting to focus in through my learning around environmental planning and biology, really learning what does it mean to create neighborhoods and human settlements that are both sustainable, not only environmentally, but financially and socially. How do we create ways to live together that we can really be proud of and that fosters all of us as human beings, as well as taking care of the earth? So I found out about the co-housing concept back in 1990, and very quickly adopted that as a version of the way that we can start figuring out ways to live together that are more sustainable. And I was fortunate enough to discover that there was a group in Colorado. I live in Boulder, Colorado. And there was a group there. I like to walk around, and this microphone, can you still hear me? But they can't record it then. So I'm stuck here. So bear with me. So I found out about co-housing. There was a group in just outside of Boulder that was very interested in doing this, and I very quickly got involved with that and moved in 1992 and lived in a co-housing community called Nyland, which was very large, about 42 households. Lived there for about 4 years as a renter, but helped them get going. I was part of the development team with that. And then there was a project happening in Boulder, a much more urban, smaller project. Moved in there in 1997 and have lived there for the last 10 years. So I've had the ability and the fortunate gift of being able to live in these neighborhoods for the last 14 years. And it really does work. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it really is a much saner way of living. So the concept that I'm going to talk about today, elder co-housing, a couple things that are important to understand about it. First is it is a non-medical option. It is really focused on how do we co-care, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that from Dean Peterson, but how do we take care of one another in a way that is that makes sense and that doesn't bring in the medical model that so many of us have had to interface with or put our parents in or grandparents. So we're really talking about a very non-medical model. And also this concept of aging in community. One of my friends and mentors is Dr. Bill Thomas. All right, how many of you are familiar with Dr. Thomas? About half of you, okay. He is a geriatrician, an MD. He's an advising consultant to the AARP. And he's been very involved with creating a number of innovative models around how we can age productively. And one of the things he talks about is that for the last 20, 30 years, there's been this concept called aging in place that really seems to be a buzzword and that people really like that idea. And he points out in one of his talks that I attended that aging in place is not a thing. It isn't anything. It's a total reaction to the horrible situation that people have been put in the last 30 years where they couldn't stay in their home and they had to go someplace that really wasn't very good for them. So what he's saying is that aging in place is people grasping for a solution on how do you stay in a surrounding that is supportive for you, that's familiar to you. The problem is that most of us live in an environment where if we were to just stay there, if you're married, eventually one of you is going to pass away and you're going to be alone, and your home probably does not support you in being able to age in that place. And the chances are also that you don't know your neighbors. You really don't have a sense of who's around. They're certainly not someone you can necessarily call for help all the time. So the idea of aging just in your home really is not going to work for very many people. So the idea is what if you can get yourself into a situation where you are in a home that's surrounded by people you know, surrounded by people that care for you, and that is designed in a way that you can actually stay there, that you can continue to live there, even if you have medical situations that require additional care. So the idea that we're promoting is called aging in community. And it's something that we coined, not all that long ago. I think Del Webb refers to what they have as aging in community, but they have it's really a different model. But the idea is that you can stay in your home and be surrounded by people that know and care for you in a community setting. And that's really what elder co-housing is about. Okay. I want to be very upfront that what we're talking about is not new. We have not invented this in any shape or form or kind or any way you can imagine it. This is really the way people have lived for all of humanity. My background is, as I said, environmental planning and biology, and we are hardwired, I believe, genetically wired to be social creatures. We aren't designed to live off in a cave somewhere at the top of a mountain. The people who did that had volunteers who came up and brought them food all the time. They were not up there all on their own. So the reality is that we are designed to live in and always have lived in extended families and tribes and villages. And this concept that we've been promoting this last 50 years of the wonders and the joys of the nuclear family, in my opinion, is insanity. It's absolutely not possible for a small group of people, you know, a couple of adults and a couple of children, to provide all the needs that everybody needs. It's just, it's never worked. So what we're really talking about is going back to the idea of surrounding yourselves with a wide variety of people who can help support you and can help take care of you, and that you can continue to grow intellectually, you know, till your last days. The co-housing concept is something that started specifically in Denmark for pretty much the same reasons it's happening here. They have, you know, very busy lives. It's a first world country. They are a lot of families with two working parents and kids that are having to figure out how to survive when the parents aren't even home. So they figured out a small group of people about in the early 70s, late 60s, said, we've got to figure out a way to rebuild our neighborhood so that they work for us. And they came up with this concept. Now, in Denmark, they're called bofællesskabers, which translated literally means living community. And the people who brought it to this country said, that's not going to fly here. So they gave it the generic term co-housing, which in some places, and I work with groups all over the country, in some places we don't even use that word. Like I work with a group in Dallas, and if you start using the word co-something, you're already cooked. So we really try to focus in on what is this concept like, and then we can tack on the name later. But this concept started in Denmark back in the early 70s. There's now about 400 of these neighborhoods there, which is very good for a country with a population of 5 million. And they are spread pretty much all over the country. Now, Denmark's a little bit of a different country from here. How many of you have actually been to Denmark? Oh, a lot of you. Great. It's quite different in a number of important ways. And one of the biggest ones is that it's very homogeneous. There's not a lot of diversity there. So it's not as difficult to bring people together around a concept because they're used to working together. It's a socialist government. There's a lot of advantages. The other is that the government is very, very supportive of a lot of these innovative options. And they also, about 20 years ago, stopped building nursing homes. They really divided out housing from medical care. And their medical system is a cradle-to-grave system that really provides service, you know, all the way through your last breath. So it is a much more sophisticated and, I think, enlightened healthcare system that they have there. But I do see glimmers of us moving in that direction. So what happened was, is about 15 years ago, a husband and wife team went to Denmark and basically said, this makes sense. We'd like to see this happen here. They brought it to this country, and the very first co-housing neighborhood in the United States was completed in 1991. Now it's in Davis, California. Since then, about 100 have been completed, and of those 100, three of them are for people 55 and above, this elder co-housing version that I'm referring to. The rest are for people of all ages. So there are about 5,000 people, 5,000 to 6,000 people living in these neighborhoods, and about a third of them are over 55. So we have a lot of experience of seeing how people in this age bracket both like the model and how well it's working. And what we've discovered is for a lot of those neighborhoods, they'd never really built in the philosophy of how do we take care of ourselves and each other as we age. It's been pushed much more by younger people and families with young children because it's a fabulous way to raise young children. But as people begin to age, they're realizing two things. One is that their home maybe doesn't really work for them as they get older. Stairs, distances, things like that. The common facilities that they have maybe aren't designed so well for them. And on the other side of it is the work expectations were not really tempered to work for people who possibly couldn't do the physical work that was needed. So a subset of these people began to say, you know, we love the co-housing concept, but how about being able to create a model that works for people who are older? And that's pretty much how the elder or senior co-housing came into being. Several elements of these communities that are common throughout, and I'm going to show you a lot of examples of neighborhoods so you can see they are quite varied. But there's basically six elements. I think I've got five of them here. The first is that it's really designed to promote a sense of community. What we've discovered, and I think Well, Drew was talking about it in one instance, but like in the Native American culture, when you think about a Native American village, be it a Pueblo or Indians that move around and have teepees, they've designed their housing so that it really works as a sense of community. You know, you envision the circle of teepees. Well, that's intentional. So you can see one another, you can watch out for one another, you can kind of help care for each other, and you can see what's going on in the center of the village, in the Pueblo, where it's, again, very tightly clustered. So the co-housing communities are designed in such a way that it makes community easy to happen. Most housing that we have in our country, especially clustered housing, is designed to create a sense of privacy. So it's really, you have to go through a lot of extra work in order to connect with your neighbor. The whole garage syndrome where you push the button, you drive into the garage, and you go directly into your house, specifically is designed to create a sense of privacy and to keep us separated from one another. So you'll see in these examples that these neighborhoods really are designed to help make it easy for people to connect with one another. Second aspect up here is the collaborative decision making. Almost of the 100 communities, I would say essentially all of them, in their development phase and in their operation, use a form of consensus decision making or some form of collaborative decision making to make all of their decisions. And we found early on that that's a really, it's a critical piece of this, because you're talking about a very intimate subject, your housing, and how you're going to run the neighborhood that you're creating. And using the old-fashioned version, or I should say the majority version of majority-minority voting, really doesn't work in this situation. You have to have buy-in by the vast majority of the people in order to be able to make good decisions and to have them stick. So we spend a lot of time helping to train people on how do you make consensus decision-making decisions, how do you run meetings this way, how do you deal with conflict, so that not only can they go through and in the development process and make good decisions, but they know how to run their homeowners association once they move in. So it's also something that we find is used outside. These people learn these skills, and then they come to a meeting at their school or at their work or in their local government, and they really can contribute well because they know how to make decisions and how to run meetings well. The next one is the combination of private homes and common facilities. And this is something that I think is making this concept very, very attractive to people. Because when people think of community, quite often the version that they think of are the intentional communities of the 60s and 70s. And the version there is that for the most part, not all of them, but for many of them, people shared everything. And they were at a younger age in the beginning, so it was fine. It was kind of like the big shared house, like the big chill concept. But the reality is that for a lot of people in our country, they're not going to go to that extreme of changing their single-family private home and move into a large house with a bunch of unknown people. However, there's a book that I was just given called The Last Resort. Any of you heard of it? It's fairly new, the last couple of years. It's a really funny, a quick read, and it's talking about a group of people who were thinking about how they wanted to age together and how nervous they were about not wanting the typical models. And what they did is they all went out, and it's about 12 people, and they went out and they bought a mansion. And they renovated it, and they all moved in, and then they hired a cook, and they hired a gardener, and they hired a nurse so that they could be taken care of in their later life. So there's many models that people are beginning to think about in terms of how are we going to age. And we've got all these McMansions, and I am so glad we have them all, because when those people, you know, lose it and move out, we're going to have all these great, huge buildings that we can move into with great big kitchens and lots of rooms. So I think they're doing us, unexpectedly, they're doing us a big favor, even though I'm not very happy with it right now. So the idea with co-housing is you've got your private house, you have your own kitchen, your bathrooms, bedrooms, you know, you've got the basic things you need, and then you also have extensive common facilities. So when you come home, you have a choice between privacy and community, and they're pretty equally weighted, so it's really easy to choose either one. And that balance of privacy and community in this model is really one of the keys that is causing people to be attracted to it. And then the last one here is the scale. So many models out there for housing, especially for retirement communities, are so large that there's just no way you can connect with your neighbors. It's overwhelming. You can't really make decisions. So in co-housing, you'll see that a lot of these are on a scale of like 15 to 35. There's exceptions, but they're in that range. So when you're thinking about this kind of a model, or any kind of model, I would really encourage you to think on a scale that is really human. And isn't it? It can't. If it's really small, then you lack a sense of diversity. And obviously, if it's really big, it's very difficult to get things done. So co-housing falls into this range. Okay. Yeah, I will. I'll do it in the slides. So I'm going to give you some examples. The reason I want to show you this is that even though this concept is a fairly rigid concept in terms of what's important, the way it plays out is extremely varied. So this first one, this is Muir Commons in Davis, California, the very first one in the country. They're about 17 years old now. And this one was started off being permanently, not permanently, started off being affordable. Almost, I think 23 of the 26 homes were all affordable. And that was because the developer needed a certain percentage of affordable homes in their larger development and were able to basically funnel them all into the co-housing. Davis is a university town, so there was a lot of interest here from people who were part of the university, some graduate students, things like that. But what you see here is how it's organized along a pedestrian pathway, really good for people to be able to look out and see what's going on outside. The other thing you'll notice, well, you won't see it, so I'll tell you, is that the kitchens are on the front side of all of the homes. So when you're standing at your kitchen doing dishes or prepping food or whatever, you can look out into the community, and they can look in. So there's a certain kind of a semi-private space on the front of your house, and all the private spaces are on the backside. Okay. Another example, this is Harmony Village in Golden, Colorado. Very different style, but same concept. The houses are clustered. This is on about 2.5 acres. They're clustered along this pedestrian pathway, and then the picture was taken from the common house, the second floor of the common house. So one of the advantages is that you have this super duper clubhouse that is really designed as an extension of your living room. I'll describe more of it inside in another picture here. But the whole idea here is that this is a way for, this is kind of like the common promenade to be able to see what's going on outside. Next. So here's a whole other story. This is a renovated office building in Silver Spring, Maryland, sitting on 1 acre. And the developer, whose background is in both senior and affordable housing, and trying to be very environmental, created this neighborhood and said, we really want to try to show a very light environmental footprint. So this is the very first LEED certified co-housing community in the country. It's pretty big, 56 homes inside, but it's very, very energy efficient. They took the parking lot that was in the middle of the building and created a plaza and then pushed all the parking on the outside. So that's the other thing you'll see, is that it's really pedestrian oriented with cars on the outside. Okay. This is Pleasant Hill, California, in the North Bay area. I like this photo for two reasons. One is it kind of gives that village feel, kind of like walking down an old European street. The other is you'll notice that there's a cart in the front here on the left side, and that's often because the parking is not connected to the houses. It's usually behind the houses, or sometimes it's even more remote than that, and they use carts like that to be able to get from the car to your house. Now, in certain environments, like in Colorado where it snows, we can't do it all the time, but a lot of the time we can. This is a brownfield infill site in Jamaica Plain, which is a suburb of Boston. And you'll see there's a lot going on right here in this picture. And this building in the front is their common house. And the idea is to think of it as an extension of your living room. It is a space that is really designed for people to use together. So what you'll find in there will be a big kitchen, sometimes a real gourmet kitchen, and a dining room that seats maybe 60 to 70% of the community, and then shared bathrooms, and then a whole variety of other things depending on what the group wants. For example, there's typically guest rooms. And that's really nice. If you've got your children or your grandchildren or your mother-in-law or a teenager that's lost it, you have a space to send them. To be able to have some space and to be able to invite people to come visit you, but they don't have to be in your home. And the other advantage is you don't necessarily have to build in that space, that room, in your home. So you can actually cut down the size of your home a little bit, and Dean will talk about what they ended up doing. You can cut down the size of your home a little bit and transfer that square footage over to the common building. So instead of this being a clubhouse that gets used a couple times a year for an annual meeting or a 4th of July potluck, this is something that gets used all the time. So here's a Friday afternoon music happening at Jamaica Plain, where they just set up in the courtyard and are playing music. This may be a planned event, or it may just be something spontaneous. But they get used, you know, all the time. And not only by the co-housing community, but as a resource to the wider community. We actually have a variety of events that happen in our community that make it available to other, you know, other groups. Yeah? Okay. So the question was, where are most of these located? And it really varies. There are very few that are really rural. For the reasons you just mentioned, you don't have access to services. Most of the people who are interested in these want to be near the action. But land in the center of town can be extremely expensive and hard to find. So what we find is a lot of these are in smaller towns or right on the edge of town where the development is still, there's still spaces available there. But they do vary quite a bit. So, but the other thing that you'll see here is because they cluster the houses on a lot of the property, they can create their own open space, even if it's in kind of a suburban or semi-urban spot. Okay. So this is where I live. This picture was taken a couple of years ago. This is the smallest co-housing neighborhood in the country, just 11 households. The other one you saw in Silver Spring is the largest at 56. But the concept is the same. There's houses on either side. There's that row there across the way, and then there's a row where I'm standing to take the picture. Or not I'm standing, I'm down there, or someone else. And it's basically the village square where you have the green in the center. And that little sitting area really has kind of grown. We've talked several times about figuring out a way to enlarge in it, because now we have a bigger table there and an umbrella and more chairs, and that's one of our gathering spaces. And it's really designed in many ways to create a sense of spontaneous gathering around. This one in Denver, Colorado, is part of one of the trends that I'll mention at the end of co-housing becoming part of a larger new urbanist development. There's a lot of developments going on, I think over 100 right now around the country, where they are trying to recreate a sense of neighborhood by building denser environments that have both mixed-use housing and retail and other kinds of housing all in a very close neighborhood. And we're finding that co-housing neighborhoods are really, really good fits within those. Okay. This, as you can see, was designed by Dr. Seuss. The architect, Michael Black, is a wonderful 70-year-old little kid, and he lives there. He designed several other co-housing neighborhoods that he lived in as well. So it can be a fun place to live, and this was just created. That's why the landscaping is still very immature. And this last example is another very urban example. This is in Oakland, California, and that entire block, it'd be good to have a pointer for this, but that entire building sat vacant for about 25 years, called Swan's Market. And a nonprofit developer decided that they wanted to bring it back to life. And what they did is they did a variety of things where they created retail around the outside. Can I turn this? Oh, good. They created retail around the outside. There's that apartment building is an affordable apartment building. There's a children's museum. And then along that spine, kind of in the middle, and you can see the picture to the right, is a 20-home co-housing community. So this is an example of being in a very urban, they don't have any green space, but these are people who wanted to be, you know, in the middle of town. So one of the, Kay mentioned, we give a workshop a couple times a year called Getting Started Workshop, which is helps people. We gear it toward the development professionals as well as future residents, talking about how do you make these things happen. And I had a gentleman come to one of my talks one of these workshops at the very beginning a couple years ago, and he said, "Have you read this book?" He is a consultant to mega churches, very, very large churches with tens of thousands of families. And he said that they're having to struggle, they're struggling with the issue of how do they create a sense of community in these huge churches. So he gave me this book and thought I'd find it useful, and I read it, and there's a chapter in there that really hit home. And the chapter is basically, you know, what are the five characteristics that you need to create community around a place? First one is people need to be available for one another. You need to have enough time to be able to do more than just say hello. The next is you need a sense of spontaneity. You need to be able to not have every time you see everybody in a planned event so that unexpected, exciting things can happen. The third is frequency. You need to be able to see people often enough so that they have a chance to build these sense of community and relationship with one another. You know, once a month, once a week, really isn't necessarily enough. You need to see people pretty frequently to build this sense of community. Fourth, breaking bread together. If people can share meals together and be able to spend that kind of informal time doing a very basic thing together, it builds a sense of community. And the fifth one is geography. If you can get these people together, if you can get them close enough together to be able to make the other things happen, then you really have the key. And when I read this, I thought, wow, this is why co-housing works. Because we have all of these things. And I would say this is, whenever you're thinking about any version of community, think about incorporating in these five elements, because it really is the key to allowing people to build bonds, especially if you're talking about an intentional community. The reason that that small towns have the feel that they have is because over decades and generations, this kind of thing has always happened. So if you're going to create something intentional and something quick, relatively, within a couple of years, then you need to build in these kind of systems so that you can really generate that kind of sense of community that it typically would take, you know, many, many years to generate. So who is interested in these kind of communities? Well, I think all of you will probably fit into this category. How many of you have heard of a label called the cultural creatives? Almost just a few. Okay. A gentleman by the name of Dr. Paul Ray wrote this book that you see up here about 10 years ago. And he's a marketing analyst. And he was surveying people over many, many years, 25, 30 years. And he discovered that there's a whole subset of America that really doesn't fit into the categories of liberal and conservative and Democrat and Republican, but that there's a new model emerging. And he gave it the name cultural creatives. And there's a test. If you go to this website, culturalcreatives.org, you can take a little test on the side and see whether or not you are a cultural creative. And I would bet that probably the vast majority of you are. So I took the first five that I thought were the most important in terms of who are co-housers, because most co-housers tend to be these people. They are well-educated. A lot of them have advanced degrees. They are concerned for the environment, and that varies dramatically. It can be just someone that feels that global warming is an issue and they want to try to do something about it and replace some light bulbs or turn off the water when they brush their teeth, all the way up to living in a very energy-efficient house or driving an energy-efficient car or not driving a car at all. So they tend to really have some consciousness around wanting to live more lightly on the planet. They tend to volunteer. Very involved, politically, socially, religiously, they're involved in things. And they tend to be very busy people, but those are the people that get things done, I find. The next is that they're involved with personal growth. They definitely are wanting to keep growing. And that's really a tendency of these people who are looking for new options, looking for new ways of doing things, and co-housing just tends to be one of their new models. And the last one is that they really don't buy into the more is better mentality. The whole concept of these communities where you're bringing people together, where you're sharing things, you're going to be able to go buy one really big, wonderful lawnmower as opposed to having 25 or 30 lawnmowers. All of those things enable you to not have to buy as many things, and the houses tend to be a little smaller. So often there's a huge garage sale before everybody moves into these because they have to get rid of some of their stuff. Dr. Bill Thomas, I mentioned earlier, he's written a number of books, and one that I read not long ago that I really appreciated was this one, What Are Old People For? How Elders Will Save the World. He talks quite a bit about the importance of this, of becoming an elder. But he also, in this book, he talks about three stages of life, and I'll just touch on it briefly. First one is childhood. And that's really the phase when you're gathering and you're learning and you're totally protected and you're really you're just coming into the world. The second phase is adulthood, and that's where the vast majority of our society either is or wants to become or wants to stay. It's really the goal in our society is to stay young, and there's a multi-billion-dollar industry out there that's trying to make sure we can stay as young as long as possible. But there's this third phase called that he calls elderhood, that in our culture we collectively are trying to re-enliven it and bring it back and talk about the importance of it. And that's really the focus of this elder co-housing community, is to focus on creating community for that phase of life. A lot of one of the comments he mentions that I think is really telling is, he says, one of the biggest problems in our political system right now is that we have a bunch of adults running around with no supervision. There's an organization that was just recently created, I don't know how many of you have heard of it, called The Elders, started by Kofi Annan and Nelson Mandela. I believe Jimmy Carter is part of it. I don't know if it's really hit the front page yet, but it's an organization that they are just basically saying, we need a global elders council now because we need some guidance from people who've lived long enough that have it. So I'm hoping that that will take off. So the elder co-housing concept. Next. I already mentioned this. The reason we use elder is not age-based, but it's much more to bring back the wise voice of the elder. This gentleman, Barry Barkin, created an alternative nursing home in Oakland, California, and I'd like to read this because it's a great quote. What is an elder? An elder is a person who is still growing, still a learner, still with potential, and whose life continues to have within it promise for and connection to the future. An elder is still in pursuit of happiness, joy, and pleasure, and her or his birthright to these remain intact. Moreover, an elder is a person who deserves respect and honor, and whose work is to synthesize wisdom from long life experience and formulate this into a legacy for future generations. And this is really something that we are missing. And part of my goal as I begin to move into this phase is to reclaim this. So the elder co-housing concept, very simply, it's a housing concept which offers proactive adults 55 and above the opportunity to live interdependently and age in community within a close-knit group of neighbors. And as Drew mentioned earlier, this interdependence piece is critical, because for so long in our society we have talked about independence, whether we have it or not, that's really the mantra. And then we are running as fast as we possibly can away from the concept of being dependent, because that certainly doesn't feel good. So really what we're trying to promote here is the reality of our interdependence with one another. So there's 10 principles that make up what elder co-housing is, since I don't have them all memorized. The first one is participatory process. These people are involved in it. It doesn't mean they design their own house, but it does mean that they're involved in the process, giving input along the way, and moreover, talking a lot about how are they going to be able to live once they move in there. I only have 5 minutes, huh? Okay, I'll talk faster. Next. They get together and they form a set of shared values and visions so that they really know that they're all talking about the same thing. And that's a process that happens during the development phase. Next. As I mentioned before, it's designed to promote a sense of community. And designed for people to age in place. It's not hard to do that if you do it at the beginning. We're talking about, you know, stairless entry, having wider doors, building in ways to put in grab bars later on down the line, and also having space like in the common house for treatment rooms or care rooms or end-of-life room. So it doesn't take a whole lot more to be able to adapt to this. And the reality is that we would like this to be available for everybody. It doesn't matter. How old you are. Okay. I mentioned before shared common facilities, and usually much more than you would have in another kind of a development where you really have a big space, like a 3,000 to 5,000 square foot building in addition to your own home. Resident managed. This is something that even though the group may not do all of the work together, they're very involved in overseeing the work that gets done. The collaborative decision-making I mentioned, it's really a critical piece of this. It just doesn't work if you've got a majority rule kind of a situation. Next. Despite what the New York Times says, these are not communes. It's not a new kind of commune. The only real sharing you have economically is the homeowner's dues. These are like condominium or townhouse developments where you have a homeowner's association that owns the common building, and that way you're paying into that every month, some kind of dues. But other than that, it's totally independent. And you don't earn your living from the community, unlike some of the other intentional communities that may have had a farm or some kind of business. Co-housing communities are are almost entirely just residential communities. Spiritual eldering, this is something that is mentioned by Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi in his Aging to Saging book, where this is a time for people to be able to elder one another, to mentor each other, to mentor the next generations, things like that. And it's really a real advantage to bringing people together and giving them this time. I think a quote that Dean mentioned from Drew is that this is the time that people can really develop their soul. And that's definitely can happen in these communities. And the last is the environmental consciousness I mentioned before. So there's three elder co-housing communities that are completed in the country. Two basically started at the same time, in the early 2006. This is Glacier Circle in Davis, California. It's just 8 homes, and it was self-developed by the group, and they'll be the first to tell you, don't do that. It's even though it was only 8 homes, it's a tremendous amount of work. But they're clustered around around the courtyard, and they have a common house. This is one picture that I took of Dean's community, Elder Spirit, 29 homes on 3.7 acres. Dean will tell you a lot more about the details of it, but just gives you an idea of again, how these can be organized. And then the third one, which had their grand opening yesterday, is Elder Spirit, is Silver Sage in Boulder, Colorado. And this one is actually across the street from a multi-generational co-housing community called Wild Sage. So I'll clip through these last few pretty quickly. There's a number of trends that we're starting to see that I think as you're thinking about creating some kind of community, you might want to look at these options. One is that there's a lot of churches out there that have land that have aging congregations. And we're thinking that they are going to be people who are going to want to figure out how do they take care of their congregants. And one way to do that is through through building housing on their property. The other I've been contacted by quite a few administrators of continuing care retirement communities where they are trying to figure out how are they going to survive the baby boomers because the baby boomers are not interested in what they have to offer. So one concept is to be able to take, again, some property on their site and to build an elder co-housing neighborhood right on their property where people can live independently, but when they need medical care, it's basically right close by and they can it can be brought over. I actually already mentioned this. This is the circle you see there is Wild Sage, co-housing community in Boulder, as part of this larger new urbanist development. Okay. Bill Thomas has also come up with an innovative nursing home option for new construction called the Greenhouse, which is a 10-bed nursing home. that basically looks like a home. You can see they have meals together. There's a big kitchen in the middle. And it's something that is really being seriously looked at all across the country. I think there's about 30 of them right now. But it's the idea of creating a small-scale nursing home. And this could be one home within a co-housing neighborhood where you've got maybe a 25 or 30-unit elder co-housing neighborhood and have a greenhouse or two as part of that. So it's a way to kind of build the future CCRC with elder co-housing and a greenhouse as part of it. You can build one of these next to intergenerational co-housing, which is something that they've done in Denmark quite a bit, and we're starting to see that. That Silver Sage, as I said, is right next to Wild Sage. And so that's that part. And then the very end is the company that I'm part of, Abraham Pace and Associates. We help groups at the very beginning, as Kay mentioned. And this is my wife, Neshama. We started our company in 1992. We've helped about 25, a few more now, groups around the country. And the most important piece is that we've lived in co-housing since 1997. So we really do, we live what we talk about. And couple of resources, they're out on the table in the bookstore along with a number of others. The original co-housing book in the very top, kind of talking about multi-generational and how to do it. It's a really very colorful, it really explains quite well. And then the lower book, Senior Co-Housing, that Chuck Durrett did, mostly talks about what they did in Denmark. Since it just came out, we don't have very many examples here. But it just gives an idea of, again, how they're doing this in Denmark and what can we take from that. And finally, that's it. So thank you very much.